cold fear. The fear of the murderer disposing of the body, which would give deadly evidence against...
I laid the carpet in the backyard and threw about 20 or 30 buckets of water on it to try to wash the blood off. And the colour of the water that came off was like blood.
Next thing I remember was something scratching and pulling at my mouth. I opened my eyes, and Jean was lying there under me, and I had my hands around her throat.
Murder Most Foul. Six classic murder cases presented by Nick Ross. Case 6, The New Year Nightmare.
A crowded pub on New Year's Eve, and things are going with a swing. But before the New Year is a few hours old, one of these people will be dead. The subsequent trial for murder will prove to be one of the most remarkable in the history of English law. A trial that lawyers still argue over.
Give me another vodka and whatever it was, tonic.
Right.
Jean. Hey, Jean, what are you having? What are you drinking? What do you have, huh? What do you want?
A lot of time.
Okay, and your... Hey, what about your friend, Leather Boy?
Oh,
what do you have?
Oh, a Guinness and a whiskey. All right. Yeah, all right. Barman, that's... Wait one second. Two large vodkas, one with tonic, one with a lot of lime, and a Guinness and a large whiskey, okay? Johnny! Veronica, what are you having?
It'll be last orders, sir. Very last orders.
Huh? Thanks, Eugene. What do you mean last orders? Come on, it's 10 o'clock. Look, it's New Year's Eve. God, no extension. Come on.
Hey, not sir. Drink up, sir. Last orders, please.
What a country. Give me a break. New Year's Eve and they shut the bars at 10. What a country. Oh.
That's it, folks. Time, please. Time, please. Drink up now. Time, please. Happy New Year. Safe home. Come on, all your glasses. It's your place.
What's the
music,
man?
I'm
getting groovy.
Hey, Gene, listen. I got some vodka from the PX back home. Yeah, there's some whiskey back in the apartment. Why don't y'all come back to my place, okay? Come on. We're about to see the New Year in, okay? Veronica, Johnny, come on. Let's make a night of it. My place, okay?
Thank you, but I'm on duty tomorrow. I better get back to the base.
Gee, you want to come back? Are you friends? Come on.
Yeah,
okay.
Why not? Hey, Dave, let's
come
back with you,
too. Yeah, thanks. Thanks, right?
Okay, I'll get a taxi. Where do I get a taxi? Out here?
The Bell Hotel at Braintree, Essex, on the last day of 1960. The Bell was popular with U.S. airmen stationed at the nearby fighter base at Wethersfield. And the Americans were popular with local girls. The swinging 60s were just beginning, and by all accounts, pretty 20-year-old Jean Constable was a woman of her times, especially in regard to U.S. airmen. But on the 31st of December 1960, her intentions were elsewhere, as tipsily she told the taxi driver.
I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, I'm going to sleep with this American. Well, you're wrong. Eugene's a respectable married man. Married to a Scotswoman. June. Oh, June, sorry. Even if she is away at the moment. And he's got two lovely kids.
No, three now. I got a new one. Yeah,
I'm not, you know, with him. No. I'm going to sleep with a civilian.
Hey, stop here. Stop. We're here. This is my place, okay?
What is this? That's spooky. Those towers, it's like out of a Hammer horror film. Dracula's castle,
eh? Nah, it used to be the old Dunmore workhouse, did you believe it? And it looks pretty grim outside, but the apartments are okay. You go on in. We'll play some records. How much, Gabby?
Oh, Laura. I love her.
Hey, I know your name. Quiet down a bit. That's Clara, the neighbor. Sorry, Clara!
You want another
dance, please? No, I can't. I'm pooped. I can't.
Oh, cool.
No. You kids go ahead. I don't know where you get your energy from. Tell you the truth, I'm not feeling that good. I had three teeth out this morning. You dance with your friend. I might go lie down, okay? You pour another drink, will you?
Hey! Hey, look at the time!
Put the radio on, quick!
Wait, whoa! Oh, come on!
to that. Happy 1961.
Should all acquaintance be
forgotten? Hello? Hello, is that the police? I want to report something. Sydney Ambrose, I'm a van driver. I was on my way to work and, to be perfectly honest, you know, I want to answer a call of nature. Anyway, I saw this lying there, by the road, lying there. A body in the ditch. A young woman, it looked like. Yes, the A604, the heading onto Haverhill Road, Oak Hill. There's a marshy bit, you know it? Sanborn Slough.
This was the morning of the 3rd of January. The police were on the scene almost immediately, but it wasn't till early afternoon that the pathologist arrived.
Chief Inspector Burden?
Hello?
Dr. Kemp.
Ah. Now, the body's over there, sir. It was found about 9 o'clock this morning. Mm-hmm. I got here myself at 9:55.
A young woman, I believe?
20 or so. Pretty. Dressed for a party or something. Linen blouse, black bra, black gabardine skirt, pink pants. No shoes or stockings, and no outer clothing.
Really?
Well, it doesn't look like she was a hitchhiker. Not someone picked up, not in this weather. No coat. Ah, here we are. Thank you, Constable. Well, there she is, Dr. Kemp. All yours.
Mm-hmm. I see. What happened to her hair?
Seems to have been chopped to birth.
Yes, it does. Oh, yes. Scratches on the neck. The front of the neck, at least.
Yes, I noticed that. Strangling.
Could be.
I couldn't see any other signs of violence.
No, there's certainly nothing obvious. Not that that proves all that much. Look,
there's not much I can do here. We better get her off to the mortuary.
At the mortuary, Dr. Camps established the cause of death, asphyxiation. Meanwhile, Jean Constable had been reported missing by her parents, and it didn't take long to identify the body. Jean was known to have been friendly with airmen from the base at Weathersfield, and next day, January the 4th, Detective Inspector Jevons, head of the Braintree CID, went to the base. Good relations between the Americans and the locals were important to both groups, and the police were given complete cooperation by the U.S. Air Force. Scores of servicemen were interviewed. Until...
This is the one I was telling you about, Inspector.
He's a Constable.
I doubt it. He's a good family man, married to a Scots lass with 3 bairns, shall we say. But he was seen with a girl at New Year, and there was a young Englishman involved, some apprentice. Like I say, Beauchere's is a good man, but he may not want to remember.
What?
One of our guys, an L man, name of John Smith, says that Beauchere's and Jean went back to Beauchere's apartment with this English fellow. Beauchere's wife was away in Scotland. Now, I'm not saying that Beauchere's...
You think it might be the Englishman?
It could be, but Sergeant Beauchere's may not want to remember whatever happened that night. You know, a young girl, his wife away.
Do we know the Englishman's name?
Sure. Smith says his name was Salt. David Salt.
Right. We better call Sergeant, Beauchere's in.
Send in Staff Sergeant Beauchere.
Sir, at ease, Sergeant. If you'll excuse me, Inspector.
Thank you, Provost Morrison. Please sit down, Sergeant.
Sir.
Now then, you are Staff Sergeant Willis Eugene Beauchere's of the 20th Field Maintenance Squadron of the United States Air Force.
Yes, sir.
And you live at 4 the Close, Great Dunmow, Essex.
Yes, sir.
Tell me, do you recognize the young woman in this photograph?
I do, sir. It's Jean Constable.
And when did you last see Miss Constable?
On New Year's Eve, sir, at the Bell. She had this English guy with her. She'd picked him up that evening.
And then?
That's it, sir.
Is it? That was all? Yes.
Well, we took a taxi, and they came back to my apartment, my flat. I mean,
I see. Back to your flat. Tell me, what happened there?
Well, I don't know, sir. I drunk too much. My mind was a blank.
I suggest you try to recall what happened.
Well, sir, you know, Jean seemed to find this English guy, this David, pretty attractive, so I just left him to it. And when I got up in the morning, they'd gone. I admit it, I passed out. So I don't know, sir.
They'd left in the middle of the night?
Yes, sir. Or maybe the early morning. I don't know, like I said. I passed out.
The bruise under your eye and the scratch. How did you get them?
I can't say, sir. I said I passed out. Look, my mind was a blank. I didn't eat, and I drank too much.
This mysterious David, did you hear his surname?
No, sir. No. I never got... I mean, she'd only ever met him that evening. It was just one of those kind of, you know, one-night things. That's Jean for you. Quite a girl.
The young man's name is Salt. David Salt, Sergeant Bershears. Are you sure you've told me everything? Absolutely everything that happened that night.
Yes, sir. Like I said, she was hot for this David. I didn't touch her.
Are you quite sure, Sergeant? You've told me everything.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I have to tell you that I'm very far from being satisfied that what you've told me is completely true. Sergeant?
Well, no, sir, I guess...
Yes, Sergeant?
I guess I may as well tell you the truth.
Ah. You elect to make a statement.
I do. Yes, sir, I do.
It was a most remarkable statement. So remarkable that the detective inspector preferred not to reveal its substance to Lady Plummer, the chairman of the magistrates, when Bourchiers was remanded into custody at Castle Headingham.
I should say that on Wednesday, January the 4th, at 3 p.m., I interviewed the accused American, Willis Eugene Bourchiers, in the Air Police Office. In the course of my interview with him, he made a statement under caution, which I do not propose to put in at this stage.
Very well, and if that is what you wish, Inspector, please continue.
Thank you, Your Worship. I should say that Sergeant Bourchiers also handed me certain property which he took from his pockets.
Property belonging to Miss Constable?
That is correct. At 6 p.m. that day, I arrested Sergeant Bourchiers and conveyed him to Braintree Police Station, where at 8:45 p.m., in the presence of Detective Chief Superintendent Barclay and Superintendent Wood, I formally charged him with the present charge and cautioned him. He was detained.
Thank you, Inspector. Sergeant Bourchiers, do you have any questions to ask the Detective Inspector?
No, sir. No, ma'am.
Now, I gather there is some question of custody concerning the accused.
Major Carl B. Preston, the United States Judge Advocate's Department. Your Worship?
Yes, Major...
Preston, Carl B. Preston. Our plea is as follows. Under the terms of the Visiting Forces Act, we ask that the accused be remanded in United States custody at Molesworth in Huntingdonshire. We recognize that under the terms of the NATO Status of Forces Agreement, the British authorities have primary jurisdiction. But under the agreement, we also are required to ask that we receive jurisdiction.
That would mean an Air Force court-martial?
It would. I repeat, I request that Bourchiers be remanded to our custody.
Now, we ask for civil custody.
Superintendent Wood, the police oppose the American request?
We oppose it very strongly, Your Worship.
I see. I'll just confer with my colleague.
The locals don't like it. A local girl murdered, the Yanks hiscocked the accused man. Mm-hmm. And of course, bad feeling. And like Major implied, we've got every right to refuse.
Fine. Sergeant Bourchiers, you will be remanded in custody until January the 15th. In civil custody.
So the U.S. Air Force had been overruled, and subsequent events would suggest they deeply resented losing custody of their own man. Meanwhile, Bourchier's wife was in Scotland with her parents, where they had a prefab at Ayr. She'd gone there for the birth of her third child. On television, she'd seen pictures of the arrest, and she recognised the base at Wethersfield. But no name was given for the accused, and his face was covered with a blanket. She casually remarked to her brother, "It must be a Yank." When, very late that evening, two police officers knocked on the door to tell her it was her husband, she broke down. The criminal proceedings were to be continued on Friday, the 13th of January, 1961. and by then the newspapers had taken up the case from the local Dunmow Broadcast and District Advertiser to the Times of London. People learned that Boshiers was something of a hero. In the Korean War, he'd flown almost 50 combat missions as rear gunner. He'd been awarded the Air Medal with 2 oak leaf clusters, the U.S. Air Force Distinguished Unit Citation, again with 2 oak leaf clusters, and several other medals and citations. But they still didn't know what he'd said to Detective Inspector Leonard Jevons on the 4th of January, the statement that had led him to be charged with murder.
Silence, please. The court is now in session.
The tiny courtroom at Castle Headingham was where Boshiers had first been remanded in custody, and where now he had to face the magistrates again. They had to decide whether there was a prima facie case against him. If there was, he'd stand trial at the next Essex Assizes to be held at Chelmsford from February the 14th onwards. It was now, at the second hearing, that the statement he'd made to Inspector Jevons was read to the open court. It was one of the most curious statements ever to come from a man who'd plead not guilty. Appearing for the Crown was Mr. E.G. McDermott.
Then, Your Worship, the accused tells how the girl and Salt came to his flat, as we have heard, how she went to sleep on the mattress after apparently undressing before the two men. In his written statement, the accused continues, the other fellow and I had a couple more drinks, and I must have fallen asleep. Not fell asleep, but passed out. The next thing I remember was the fellow waking me up and asking me where to get a taxi. I told him and took him down to the front door. I went back. Jean was still asleep on the mattress, and I lay down beside her.
Next thing I remember. You got a cigarette, Inspector?
Yes, yeah.
Thanks. Next thing I remember was something scratching and pulling at my mouth. I opened my eyes, and Jean was lying there under me, and I had my hands around her throat. And she was dead. That sort of sobered me up, Inspector.
Is that part of your statement?
Yeah, I guess it is.
Would you type that, Constable? That sort of sobered me up. Please carry on.
Well, I got scared, and I didn't know what to do. I put her clothes back on her. That was after I'd carried the body through to the spare bedroom. I left her lying on the floor of the spare bedroom.
And then,
well, after tidying up the living room, I lay down on the mattress and I went to sleep, you know. I woke in the morning. I decided it had been a dream. But I went to check. And I saw the rest of her clothes in the bathroom. And Jean in the spare bedroom. And then I saw she really was dead. I don't know how it all came about.
You didn't think of going to the police?
I wanted to, but I was too scared. I tried to figure out how to get rid of the body. And I washed the sheets and blankets. And I washed her body.
What did you do then with her?
She lay there until Monday night.
Monday night? Nearly 48 hours?
Well, yeah, not quite, but near enough.
And on Monday night?
At about 11:30, I carried the body downstairs over my shoulder, covered with my heavy winter gear, and I laid it on the back seat of my car.
What about her hair?
Yes, she had attractive hair. Well, after Jean was dead, I started to cut off her hair with scissors and burned it in the fire. I guess I did this because I didn't want people to recognize her.
You didn't want people to recognize her?
Yeah. I mean, after a while, it would be better if she was recognized. No. I mean, sorry. I mean, what I mean is, after a while, I thought I was wrong. It would be better if she was recognized. It was, you know, I drove around the country. Yeah, I thought it would be better if she was recognized.
Why?
I realized once they found the body, you'd be right after me. Anyway, I drove around till I came to some sand piles. I went by and then turned around. I carried the body and dumped it headfirst into a ditch, and then went home. Oh, one other thing.
Yes?
I burnt her fur coat, handbag, shoes, stockings, suspender belt, red garter, and jacket. And her ring. I threw her ring away through my car window as I drove along.
Yes. We wondered what happened to her after Taylor.
You see, that fur coat. She was really proud of that fur coat. Oh, come on. She was really, really proud of that. See, she had a little job in a plastic factory, but she had a fur coat. Everyone knew that fur coat. She wore it all the time. A fur coat. We all...
Beauchiers had then handed over a watch and a 10-shilling note that he'd taken from Jean's body. There was plenty of other evidence. Clara Miller, wife of another sergeant at Wethersfield, was the neighbour who'd thumped on the ceiling. She testified that around 1 o'clock, or perhaps 1:30, she'd heard someone crying.
It was like sobbing, and I heard something. Yes, I suppose sobbing. I heard something that sounded like either you love me or you don't love me, but it was muffled, like someone holding a handkerchief over her mouth.
Experts would later suggest that what she was really saying was, you're hurting me, or you're choking me. But then Jean might just have been with David Salt. There was no disagreement in court about what had happened between those two young people. But the magistrates were convinced that Beauchiers had a case to answer. He was committed for trial at Chelmsford Assizes. The Crown's first witness was Mrs. Constable.
Yes. I recognise the photograph. That's Jean.
Mrs. Constable, I'm sorry to distress you. Do you also recognize this gold watch? Would you hand her the watch?
Yes, that's Jean.
The next witness was Jean's friend, Veronica Benfield.
I was with her in the bell. She'd been drinking, but she wasn't drunk.
She wasn't drunk.
Was tiddly.
What was she drinking?
It was vodka and soda or something like that.
John Smith, airman's second class, corroborated what she'd said, and the taxi driver, Donald Mills, gave evidence about what Jean had said to him. David Salt next took the stand. He, too, was cross-examined by Beauchiers' counsel, Gerald Hines.
This was a rather merry New Year's party, and you'd had rather more to drink than usual, Mr. Salt.
Yes.
Beauchiers did nothing physically to get rid of you, to get you to leave the flat?
No, nothing at all.
And what condition were the girl and Beauchiers in when you came to the flat?
She was merry. He was pretty well sober.
And you had intercourse with the girl?
Yes. On the rug. The American had left the room.
You had intercourse once?
Twice. The second time on the bed. He left us in the bedroom.
Is this your normal course of conduct?
No.
Would you agree that the three of you had had a good deal to drink from first to last that evening?
Yes.
The key witness called that first day was Dr. Francis Camps, the pathologist. He was questioned by the prosecuting counsel, Mr. Stanley Rees.
Dr. Camps, you say that death was due to manual strangulation?
Yes. Pressure on the throat was maintained for perhaps 30 seconds.
On the findings which were made on the body, did you think it is possible that he could have killed her while asleep?
I should think it is certainly within the bounds of improbability. I should say my reason for my findings is, this process would take a certain amount of time, and during that period the person would go through certain phases of movement, and from the description of finding her suddenly dead like that, I don't feel it fits in with that type of death. He would have felt her moving, even in half sleep, I should have thought. Subconsciously, everybody protects themselves from an assault of this kind.
Dr. Camps was the last prosecution witness. The first day of the trial ended at 9:40 in the evening. Next day, it was the turn of the defence. But Mr. Hines called just one witness, Eugene Beauchiers. The defendant made an impressive figure in his formal blue uniform with its rows of medal ribbons. Standing bolt upright with crew-cut hair, he spoke quietly and with obvious honesty.
How long did Salt remain in the flat?
I can't say. I can't say what time he left.
Had the drink you had had any effect on you?
Yes, sir, very much.
What did you do after that?
I went to lay on the edge of the mattress beside her and went to sleep.
And what was the next thing you remember?
I felt something pulling at my mouth.
Were you awake when you first felt that?
No, sir.
Did you at any time make any overtures to her or have any sexual relations with her?
No, sir.
In his cross-examination, Mr. Rees made the obvious point. If Beauchesne was innocent, why did he attempt to conceal what he had done?
Were you sober when you threw the body into the ditch?
Yes, sir.
And in a sober and determined attempt to cover up what had happened, you carried the body into the bathroom and then into the bedroom. This was a calculated attempt to hide the crime.
Yes, sir.
What crime did you think you had committed?
The logical one.
What did you think was the logical one?
That I had killed someone.
But you didn't think it was a crime to kill someone when you were fast asleep.
I thought to kill anyway was a crime.
Mr. Justice Glyn Jones, summing up, spoke to the jury of this simple, sordid case.
There are only two verdicts you can give, guilty or not guilty. Have you heard before of a man strangling a woman while asleep? Do you really think that it could happen? If you do, you must find the defendant not guilty.
And that's precisely what they did. The jury, 11 men and one woman, was out for an hour and 50 minutes. They decided Eugene Beauchesne had strangled Jean Constable in his sleep and was therefore not guilty. And that seemed to be the close of the affair. According to a USAF spokesman,
as far as we are concerned, he has been acquitted of the charge, and that is the end of the matter.
But was it? At any event, a few months later, in July 1961, the US Air Force announced that Beauchesne had been dismissed from the service under other than honourable conditions. And 3 decades later, the verdict is still debated and may still appear to some to be perverse. Yet the judge's summing up was perfectly correct. If you really think a man could strangle someone in his sleep and did so, then you must find him not guilty. In British law, except for motoring offences, a killing can only constitute a murder and not an accident or misadventure or manslaughter if whoever caused the death intended to cause death, or injury at least. Assuming that the jury decided it really happened in his sleep, then Beauchesne truly wasn't guilty, even though Jean Constable was very dead.
In The New Year Nightmare, Kerry Shale played Eugene Beauchesne and George Parsons played Detective Inspector Jeevans. Other parts were played by David Bannerman, Timothy Bateson, James Green, Emma Gregory, Jenny Howe, Joanna Myers, Michael Turner, and Angus Wright. Murder Most Foul was written by John Scotney and presented by Nick Ross. The producer was Mark Savage.